The Priestess and the Cauldron, a podcast featuring Elvira Love and Phoenix LaFay, two out-of-the-broom-closet professional witches with over 70 years combined experience of making magic. This is a show on the LMC Radio Network. During each show, Elvira and Phoenix will help you create rituals, make spells, make potions, and much more besides. They'll spend time speaking about different goddesses from all over the world, paying attention to the ancient reverence of long-ago cultures and infusing it with a modern perspective. Elvira, Phoenix, take it away.
We're taking it away. On.
Whoa.
Well, we are doing this sort of in a standard from the past to the future.
Yes.
So, obviously, our topic is druids and druidry, which, as we both found out, is a very big, very big subject.
Yes, it's probably much more than we should do in one show, but whatever.
We'll kind of iceberg it. We'll do the tip of the iceberg process.
Right.
I'm more into the concepts of weather, ice, and that since we've had hail recently and snow in parts of the areas of the state that don't have it, like Sacramento.
Yeah, it's been weird.
It has been a very weird weather. So, obviously, to say, what have you done this week, is, which our normal lead-in is kind of an off-the-chart one we don't do because it won't matter.
This will be in the past.
This will be in the past. So, but I think, interesting enough, I think that when I did this research, and we had a lot of different, things that we've kind of rescheduled.
Yeah.
I found it a fascinating subject. I found it really, they liken it, the nymphs for the Greek dyads for the trees, and they liken it to, the oak. And I'm like, it's more, I see a lot of similarities, and it's not necessarily because one culture conquered another. It's how people see their environment and relate to it.
Right.
Right.
Well, I think with the subject of druids, too, we're also looking at what was an ancient concept of the druids and what is the modern concept of the druids. And they're different things.
Right.
The modern druids are reconstructionists.
Right.
Right. There is no lineage of druids that is unbroken and continuous from the time of the Romans invading Britain. It's just not. Didn't happen. The druids died out. So everything that modern druids are doing is a reconstruction and an assumption and a patchwork of the language, the writings, and the information that was left behind, which ain't a lot.
Right. Well, and if we said over many different times of traditions and, where we've come from, is we don't have that. We don't have this unbroken, written down, we can pass it to each individual generation, and some of it gets buried to the point where it is forgotten. And so there are holes in even that. And I kind of actually like the concept of reconstruction and saying, being honest, being forthright and saying, well, witchcraft right now is a reconstructionist witchcraft. Paganism is reconstruction instead of like meow.
Yeah.
When my father started working in the field of therapy and he was doing the Reichian therapy, it was called neo-Reichian therapy because it wasn't the same as the master put down, and anything that was different, it wasn't the gospel, became neo.
Right.
And then when I got into paganism and witchcraft, it became neo.
Right.
And I'm like, I understand the word is new,
Yeah.
Kind of that's what it means,
right.
Knew this. But if we could just go with reconstruction, it would make me feel a little bit better, not because I'm into construction and building and, you know, engineering, but it's the idea that we're trying to put it back together again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and when neo-paganism is used, it's often used as a sneer or a slur, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, that's just neo-paganism.
Right, and it's, you know, and I know that a lot of people call... And I have, but maybe it's I do it with a sense of endearment only because I don't know how sometimes to describe people that are really into this energy of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And so we call them love and lighters.
Right.
White lighters.
Yeah.
It's not, I think it's a way to try and pigeonhole what it is so that people can quickly grab a hold of it.
Right.
But the slur is always underneath. It can be given or it can be just dropped and
totally.
That. But that's why I like the idea of reconstructionist.
Well, I think the other thing is that a lot of, you know, the ancient system of
mm-hmm.
the Druids
mm-hmm.
Isn't really traceable. I mean, I don't know, this is so freaking complicated. The Druids as a whole, and we're, you know, again, we're saying the Druids as if they lived in Nevada and not like in an entire country and more than one country, you know, it's Wales
right.
and Britain and Scotland and Britannia and Brittany and the coast of France and Ireland. Like this is where the Druids were.
Yeah.
And they all were different and they all did things differently. And so for us to pigeonhole the ancient Druids is difficult, but they also were an oral system.
Mm-hmm.
They did not write shit down.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the writings we have on the Druids were written by monks or the Romans. The Romans, as they were trying to invade and steal the land and livelihood and religion and all of the things to
mm-hmm.
you know convert
mm-hmm.
people to Romans. yeah, I shouldn't get on that soapbox. Right.
Ah, why not?
So we have the Romans' opinions.
Right.
Right, written down. And then we have the monks' opinions written down hundreds of years later.
Right.
So we don't have a lot of from the horse's mouth.
Exactly.
And that makes it hard. And I think that's why, you know, like you were saying, reconstruction is trying to piece it back together. We'll never be able to piece it back together. The vase has shattered.
Mm-hmm.
Huge chunks are lost.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never be able to have that vase be what it once looked like.
Mm-hmm.
But it could at least be something that can hold water again and have a different look and appeal and still be a vase,
mm-hmm.
right?
Because you'll put in different pieces. It's like for a long time, I had someone in my life who was a official trained wood carver,
mm-hmm.
and he did reconstruction of different carvings on locations. So either he did it in fancy houses down in L.A. or he did it at, you know, museums. And it would be taking what you have, matching it as close as you can,
yeah.
carving it within the pattern, and then, you know, then either staining it or aging it to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
So it means you're patching it with other things to within the framework. You have a general idea, and so you flow with it. And I think that is the best you'll get.
Right.
For any of this, and specifically what we're talking about here with the Druids, because as you say, broad area of geographics, and with that, as we've talked about other deities that we describe and talk about, that it takes into account different towns, different locations, different villages.
Right.
The same thing is true here. We have different things that were done because you were in Brittany or you were in, you know, Scotland or
mm-hmm.
you were in England or you were, you know.
Right, which
France.
Makes it even more complicated to try and splice something back together.
Exactly. But
yeah.
with on that incredibly fascinating point of reference, we can kind of do a general, and then we do have the modern traditions that have their own ways of
right.
putting it together.
And I imagine eventually we'll probably dedicate a whole show to some of these traditions, but, you know, so they're going to get like a little 5-second like, this is the name of this tradition, and this is when they are started, and this is basically what they do, and here's how to find them, you know. And there are dozens of Druid traditions, mm-hmm. and some are in England, and some are in the United States and Canada, and I'm sure there are others around the world that I'm not familiar with. I'm really only personally familiar with some of those organizations,
mm-hmm.
and there are dozens, but I've really only got information about four.
Right.
Like sort of the four big ones.
Right.
Today.
Right.
But, you know, like we could talk, just to throw one out there, the OBOD, the Order of Bards, Obeids, and Druids.
Right.
Do a whole show on the OBOD.
Right.
There's so much to talk about.
Right.
So we're going to just give snippets and tastes of Druid stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll be up to you.
As the listener to see what perks your interest and go with it.
Yeah.
So... obviously, its sacred culture is the oak and nature. Oak is being, I guess, the icon of what it is. It's like I go with the plant rue.
Mm.
I will do a cult on rue.
Nice.
I like that. Anyway,
That's like the third or fourth time rue has come up in the last few weeks.
Ah. Yeah, actually, I got a little rue plant from one of the local Wiccan-based witches grouping that did a plant sale, and I have had it for years and years. We're talking a couple of decades, and it's survived everything, moves to various locations and all, and I have it here where I'm living, and... unfortunately, last year when we had our freezes, it died.
Oh.
And I was devastated. I was like, my rue plant, and it's gone. And it was official rue. It was the European rue. It actually was. And I was like, oh. So I started trying to locate in spring a rue plant. And I found through a local farm what's this tree farm? I don't remember. It's over there in Fulton.
Yeah.
They had rue, they could get it. Well, I'm sitting here thinking, it's really great. What they have is decorative rue. So it is not quite the same thing.
Right.
And so I brought it home and I replanted it and I had lots of love and everything. And we got to winter and it died.
Oh.
At least I thought it died. And then we got this strange weather that has been warm and then cold and then warm and,
weird.
And it's coming up again. So
it doesn't know what to do.
It doesn't know. So I think what it did is it went into hibernation. I think, what do they call them, perennials? Or is it perennials?
Yeah.
The ones that come up. Yeah. So notice I'm not really a plant person or gardener. But anyway, so that's my rue story, which has nothing to do, obviously, with Druidism, but it was an offshoot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rue.
I'll
write it down so I remember to look it up later.
Yeah. Whatever. So here we are. In Druidic groves, which is Northern European, how they call it, I guess what we could look at is, the practical rites that they had.
Are we going modern or ancient?
Well, let's try ancient first.
Let's try ancient.
I figure, let's throw a little ancient in there so we can get, a little foundation, just a tad, like the ones where they, have archaeologically dug up there are a couple of Druid priests that they have found.
Wow.
I know. Actually, this is where my concept of real hardcore books came in, because I started looking through my library and I found this whole thing about Druidism that I had somehow in one of my flash moments of going into bookstores and used bookstores found them. And it was about a particular priest that they, in archaeology in England, they dug up, found. And through this whole thing, they began to piece together the religion, so to speak.
Right.
But it was through the archaeology of excavations.
Right.
That they found it. Not necessarily, because you can't excavate a grove, for crying out loud. You really don't have that. They come, they go, they were cut down. Churches were put on top of them. So, you can't really get a feel. But they had this one, which is a burial site, and they found it. And I was fascinated by it. But it didn't give me a whole lot of, ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Just, these were his little medicine bags. This is what they had here. Mm. This is what they did there.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, That's my tidbit of archaeology.
All right.
Okay.
Well, I think what's difficult is, again, we're going by information from cultures that were not of the Druidic culture.
Right.
So that is, it's difficult. And there is some evidence that Druids were like the law keepers. They were the spiritual guides. They were professional class.
Mm-hmm.
They were specially trained. So, children may, there's different theories, so this may sound scattered, but there may have been a required time that every child spent with the Druids learning specific things. That's probably not true. How kids were selected to go into the Druid class, we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
But at a very early age, children would have gone in because it took 20 years of training
right. To
call yourself a Druid. And you would have probably had a specialization. But the Druids, we think of them as like magic, like Arthur had Merlin, the
mm-hmm.
Druid,
mm-hmm.
and he had these magic powers, and but he was a spiritual advisor. He understood law, and but the Druids, right? They understood law. They would help with making decisions if someone broke some of the laws or harmed another person or there was a dispute. It would be taken to the council or the Druids. If if someone needed medicine, the Druids would administer medicine. Mm-hmm. If there needed to be reports kept, right, supposedly, the Druids would do all of this. They were sort of the ones in charge,
mm-hmm.
right? But they weren't like the high king or the king or the that figurehead. They were the advisors to the figure.
Right. But like most advisors, whether we want to take it to modern day or not, they're the ones that keep all of the minutiae.
Right.
They take care of all the small details, including some of the, like big details, but they're always detail orientated.
Right.
So it makes sense.
Yeah.
For them to be, that's the class, that's the name, that's what they get called instead of advisor to, the CEO.
Right, right, right. And, some of the advice was done under the influence of hallucinogens with divining into the future
right. What
we should or should not do. But, the oldest references to the Druids comes from Julius Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere around the 50s of the BCE, before the Common Era.
Mm-hmm.
Later, there were many different Roman writers who wrote about the Druids. Cicero, Tacitus, Pliny, Tiberius, blah, blah, blah. But it's believed that by the 2nd century,
mm-hmm.
the Druids were completely wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no further written records from the invaders, from
right. The
military men like Caesar.
Right.
And the English word Druid is actually not a Gaelic word, even though we'd like to believe that it is. And there is some argument, I actually take that back, there is some argument that it is arrived from a Gaulish
mm-hmm.
word.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many different ways to break down Druid, and in Cornish and Welsh and in the different Brythonic languages,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Irish,
uh-huh.
Druid you can make an argument for Druid being a word, but it's probably it's kind of unrealistic to think that across all of these different cultures they were all using the word Druid. It's possible, but I don't know.
Highly unlikely, truthfully, because as we know, every culture takes another name and shifts it.
Right.
And if you take cultures, then just think about regions and, locations and,
Right.
So, obviously, their whole process was written about, but then, of course, the name gets stuck on them just like we've had, names stuck on us.
And it's hard, to talk about the ancient systems. Probably, at least, I have a little bit of experience. I was involved with the Druid organization for a few years in my past. It's been a long time. But
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Irish probably have the best records about some of the mm-hmm. Druidic cultures mm-hmm. and the way that they worked
mm-hmm.
because they were invaded last.
Right. Right.
Secondly is the Welsh. There's some pretty good references in the Welsh mysteries
mm-hmm.
that have some information. But, really, it was written down hundreds of years later. So
right.
It's tenuous at best.
That's true. That's true. So, you know, and I think just like we talked about, you know, Roman and Greek, and mostly it's the Romans because they kind of did their thing about going across the lands, but they took things that were similar.
Yeah.
You know, so when I jokingly said Druid and the concept of having groves and, you know, they likened it unto now that's a great thing. My word just slipped out. And
it happens.
It does. It does. But Dionysian, and I have, you know,
Dionic
traditions, but it wasn't Dionic. It was the dyads.
Oh.
It came back. I am impressed.
There you go.
A moment there where I wanted to go to another level. But the dyadian traditions, because they could think of it as, well, our people do this with trees and law and this kind of little
right.
thing, and so they plug it in. And I think that's also why the written traditions were seen from the eyes of people that didn't have any basis.
Yeah.
They really didn't, and
right.
they just tried to plug it in.
Right. Well, if you step into a culture and a society that you don't understand,
mm-hmm.
and you try, you know, if we were to travel to any other country that's not part of sort of the Western, modern Western
right.
world, we would have no construct. We would have no idea how specific day-to-day customs even work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now when we have access to the internet and can look it up, like, okay, what is day-to-day Japanese custom so when I go to Japan I don't look like a jerk?
Right.
Right?
Right.
But we still won't understand. It's not woven into the fabric of our day-to-day life. It's not woven into the way that we walk around the world. It's foreign.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what we have with Caesar going and invading Gaul and moving across into Wales. And that's where he stopped and was supposedly frightened away by the Druids, who scared the Romans from the Isle of Mona. But, you know, he invades this foreign land and really doesn't have any idea, and tries to put in his writings, him and the other warriors and prophets and soothsayers or whatever you might have called them that wrote about all this
mm-hmm.
stuff, they were trying to fit a different construct on top of it. It's like
right.
taking our Western construct and trying to explain why other countries do the things that they do. It doesn't work. You have to understand it from the inner workings of
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And I think that's why when we say this is a very big and
yeah.
broad
yeah.
topic, we knew when we picked it was going to be, because it's like, this is like the first part of any book that says, and here we are with the idea of what this, you know, came up. So we do history and we do all these things. And then the second part of the book is where we actually get into the real stuff.
Right.
So, again, this is something to be looked at as a part one, part two.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And one of the things I found fascinating as I did some of the research, and how these people, as the centuries went by, Christianity became more of the ruler of the traditional religious structures,
yeah.
is how they started, how the Druid peoples, whoever they were in terms of their priesthoods, their priestesshoods, how they became, how they wove themselves
mm-hmm.
to stay doing what they're doing, but to put a shield on,
sure.
a cloak.
Sure.
They would get into the Christian tradition, and they would do the, you know, the cloister things and the different things. I was fascinated that it
yeah.
showed some of that, mostly because by then, of course, writings and things were more prolific.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, you know, survival
yeah.
is amazing when it comes to things like this and how you
yeah.
traditionally move from one to the other.
Well,
so,
when it started with the Romans, you know, the way they started was the reason they were so good is because their army was like nothing else the world had seen up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
We can argue about that at another time.
I'm all for doing that. I'm into that kind of mood.
But also they would invade and they would cause a ruckus, and then they would go, hey, you know what? We don't want to fuck up your life. We're not trying to ruin what you've got going here. We just want you to pay tribute to Rome.
Right.
Send us some taxes, Let us send some nobles that will marry into important families. You all keep doing what you're doing. And they would go to tribes that were warring, and they'd get one of the sides on their side,
right.
And then they would smash the other parties.
Right.
Right? So you keep your gods. We're not trying to convert you. And that is how Rome was so successful. And then as it switched from BCE to CE, as it became the Common Era and Christianity really started to take a hold, not right away, because at the beginning it was still like, Christians, no, feed them to lions for
right.
a while. But as Christianity started to take more and more of a hold, that is when religious oppression really started. Is, oh, well, we need to outlaw soothsaying.
Right.
We need to outlaw prophecy. We need to outlaw the Druids. We need to outlaw all of these things because the church was trying to gain more control. Rome was losing power, but the church was gaining power. It's always about money and power.
Isn't that
always.
Interesting?
And
to
always.
This day, we could even jump into
still
political
the
shit.
Same, but still the same.
It is, and it's funny because, in a sad way, funny,
yeah.
That when you look back on history,
yeah.
Even though people say, well, history is written by the winners.
Yes.
The point is that people with the ability to find things, the common mm-hmm. denominators and the detectives,
mm-hmm.
they can find it and they can look at it and then bring it out and say, don't you see how this is what's going on?
Yeah.
And the more that comes out, the more people go, oh. Now, you're going to have a lot of people that are going to follow no matter what.
Yeah.
Because they want to follow.
The devil you know is better than the devil you don't.
Right. So, but it took a lot of strength and a lot of wiliness
mm-hmm.
to find your way into these situations and still keep who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what I found with how these individuals
mm-hmm.
moved through and into the situation.
Yeah.
And
well, and you mentioned earlier churches being built very strategically, and that was part of the
oh, yeah.
transition from, keep your stuff. We don't want your stuff to, oh, no, actually, we want your stuff, and you have to do it this way now.
Right.
You know, they would build churches on sacred sites. And uh-huh. you can still go to England and Ireland now, uh-huh. and parts of France, too, and probably other parts of Europe that I just don't know off the top of my head, like I know about these countries.
Uh-huh.
You can still go and go to the church, and then if you know the right people or if you're on the right tour or if you ask some, you know, probing questions, they'll go, oh, yeah, come to this part of the church or, oh, yeah,
uh-huh.
check out this relic.
Uh-huh.
And it's from the system before Christianity.
Right.
You know, there's the Sheila Nagigs above every church door.
Yes.
It's the green man
yes.
woven into the iconography of the churches. Like, those are pagan over.
Because there was a point where, one, they needed to find more ways to get people
yes.
to accept what they're doing.
Right.
So they give you a little bit of
yeah,
a crumb.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the second part is that, if I look at it from the empowered part, is that we can get it there to keep our energy still in.
Yeah.
In line,
yeah.
so it you
and
know.
There's a third thing for me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Why build right on top? Well, I mean, it's a conquering thing. Like
right.
yes, we have blah, we've
right.
pushed you, and we're here now. But also, there is power in that place. If we want to say we're Reconstructionists or whatever,
mm-hmm.
why did the Druids or the ancient ancestors build temples or say have sacred groves or whatever in these spots? It's because they believed that these spots held power or that, you know, the
mm-hmm.
a ring was, and the Druids did not make rings of stones. Those were way before the Druids, but whatever. Why did we go to this ring of stones to do our ritual?
Right.
Because we believe it inherently had power.
Right.
So you build a church on top of it, you're still in the power zone.
Right.
So whether the church recognizes that or not, and at different times in the church's lifespan, they have recognized that
mm-hmm.
the land holds power.
Mm-hmm.
That's ebbed and flowed over the years. But those are power points in the landscape, and there's still a huge belief about ley lines in
mm-hmm.
England,
mm-hmm.
A huge thing about ley lines, and understanding how churches, if you trace them through the
land. They go right on the ley line.
Uh-huh.
And it's fascinating because there is the one, I think it's the
Saint Michael.
Michael one that goes through, and the road to Compostela
mm.
and the pilgrimage, it is done exactly
yeah.
in terms of that is the first church on the whole process. And, you know, the interesting thing is, because I was really into this, and I still am, but it was something that really drew me into more of the witchcraft process was when I started this, I fell in love with that.
Yeah.
The energies and the way it lays on the land and under the land and how...
Show on with putting that down.
And I found that when we did wind up going to Scotland, I went into, I demanded, there's only one way, and it was long, it wasn't because of Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, but I demanded to go to Roslyn Chapel.
Yeah.
And the weird part was, is if you go there, you know where the church is and where the chapel is, and the chapel was built to begin every one of the cathedrals. It started with that, and then they would build a church, but because of what happened within the building of these churches, that was the crown. That was the last one on the line. And it didn't make it to completion as a cathedral. But if you go and you go in there, yes, there is a spot.
Yeah.
If you go up to the altar and you stand, you can feel the energy of where it is that really exists. And they, of course, made in the Da Vinci Code, you go down the stairs and into what is another part of what was an older chapel, but it is in a room that has all the names of all the things, but you can feel where it is, the anchor of it.
Yeah.
It was fascinating. I was like, excuse me, I'm working my hand, I'm kind of walking around, and people were, you know, there wasn't a lot of people there, but they had their, you know, docents and, and people watching, you know, at least there. And I'm kind of going around, you know, checking it out. And of course, at that time, my last husband was like, okay, you do that and I'll stand guard, you know. I'll hold the energy, because he was really into holding the energy. And I had a great time because I began to realize that that was pure.
Yeah.
You know, it's here in the United States, there are the same things.
Yeah, yeah, you can find ley lines. You can trace the St. Michael's line. You can trace all the way around the planet, and it connects to all of these sacred sites that have been happenstance built on the line.
Right.
Like, there's something interesting there. Yeah.
So, again, another walk on another side, but it's still because the Druids were part of the land. They were connected to the land. That was their, I don't want to say their job, but that was who they were.
Right, and they're sort of the go-between between the noble ruling class and the peasantry.
Uh-huh.
The Druids were neither of those classes,
right,
supportive of both of those classes,
right,
the go-between sometimes. So this is also a societal structure.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just about magic and woo and nature and hugging trees.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the societal structure of these cultures that are dead now, that were destroyed by the Romans.
Right.
You can't understand how I feel about
that. She does. She feels very bad. And I understand because, see, I am not Roman, but I am Italian, but I do feel that attitude, because coming from Sicily, they called it it was the football. It was the boot was constantly kicking the football, Sicily. So I do have a feeling about Romans, you know? How dare they?
Who also don't exist anymore, you know?
I mean, they've
imperialism to imperialism to imperialism, and here we are as Americans
with imperialists.
So whatever.
We also have our attitudes about that, too. But that being said, the fascinating part of this is watching how the culture kept it in a way and moved, just kept moving over the different permeations.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, so here we are in the ancient times, and if we fast forward to the 1800s, there was a revival in the UK. You know, the United States is behind as far as religious tolerance goes.
Gee, I don't know why.
I know. The UK, and this is oversimplifying. I get it. Don't write me a note. I get it. I'm oversimplifying. But for the most part, the UK considers themselves, air quoting here, post-religious.
Mm-hmm.
Their society, they believe, is not ruled by any one religion. That doesn't mean that religious discrimination doesn't happen.
Right.
But there isn't one faith or one system that is in charge.
Mm-hmm.
Right. America, the United States, can't say that.
Right. I have a that is a very bad point.
Yes. And we're behind.
Yes, we are.
So by the 1800s in the UK, this was already sort of starting to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Not on a huge scale, but this is when the revival of occult practices started to happen. This is when the revival of reading old texts about magic. This is when, you know, this is when Aradia started to wake up.
Right.
This is when the Solomon's books started to be reread and republished.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a big revival, and there was a revival about Druidism, Druidry, however you feel inclined. I've had heard it argued both ways.
Okay.
But William Stuckley, John Toland, William Blake, these are people who were involved in the late 1700s through the mid-1800s in creating this revival of Druidry,
mm-hmm.
And going back to what was considered the traditional British
right.
face of the land.
Right.
Right. And that's a lot of what modern Druidism is based off of, is what these men in this timeline started to recreate.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which again, we go into a lovely dialogue or monologue, as depends on who we are, about, you're going to love this, the men constantly finding the answers.
Well, you know, that's what was allowed in these times.
I know. Somewhere, I have a feeling we will find women who were profound.
Yeah.
That just got sent to the sidelines.
Oh, the nunnery. Well, and to be fair, Charlotte Guest is one of the most famous translators of the Mabinogian.
Mm-hmm.
She had her troubles, but anyone who's translating from one language to another is going to have their blinders about certain
right.
things, you know. But for the most part, this is what men did.
Mm-hmm.
Women didn't get to do shit like this.
I know. It's very sad.
Yeah.
So I can give a mini rant.
Of course. Yeah,
we just change direction. Usually you're the one
exactly.
doing that. So.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, also, and I feel like we have to mention his name, Ilo Morwang, which I probably pronounced wrong. I'm so sorry. His given name at birth was Edward Williams. He took that name, mm-hmm. Ilo, and he wrote a lot about the revival of Druidry.
Mm-hmm.
And his books weren't published until after he died.
Hmm.
But the Gorsith of Bards in the Isle of Britain is one of his... is that his, or am I reading something wrong here?
Well,
he also wrote the Ilo manuscripts and Bardas or Barthas,
mm-hmm.
depending on how you pronounce
mm-hmm.
the double D. Many contemporary scholars say that what he wrote and the information he collected was bunk.
Right.
But he still has had a huge influence on what modern Druidry has started
mm-hmm.
to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And on that note, we should probably take a break and then talk about modern Druidry.
Yes, I think it's a good time to switch gears.
All right, we'll be back.
You're listening to The Witch, the Priestess, and the Cauldron, a radio podcast on the LMC Radio Network. Stay tuned, as more magic is coming your way right after these messages. The LMC Radio Network is a media alliance whose excellent shows include the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour with Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ollie, Sundays 3 to 4:30, the Crystal Silence League Hour with John St. Germain, Tuesdays 5 to 6, Fit and Foxy, Madame Nadia and Jaya Danya, Wednesdays 6 to 7, and The Witch, the Priestess and the Cauldron with Elvira Love and Phoenix LeFay, Fridays 6 to 7. All times Pacific, add 3 hours for Eastern, sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com.
That's so quick.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have a concern that I missed out. We were just trying to get a general, like, what is the modern Druidic definition?
Yeah. I think it's, if I had to give it a definition, I would say that it is earth-based spirituality.
That's true.
Right? Because
right.
the different organizations work with different deities. Some don't work with deities at all.
Mm-hmm.
Some are totally great and open to having the the Christian deities be the ones worked with. Like you can still be a druid and go to church with at, you know, the Baptists or whatever. So I think it's hard to give one descriptor, except there's a, I think, a universal agreement that it is nature-based.
Nature-based. I would agree with that. I know that in one way, I call them environmentalists.
Sure.
You know, because they're really into the environment and keeping it pristine, and you know, because then you can commune with the pristine environment rather than, you know, cluttered up.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, to me, this is a way to promote, you know, like the connection and reverence to the natural world.
Right.
So that kind of gives you a base. Now we will switch to the various ones.
Yes.
Yeah.
When I found online this very handy dandy chart.
Oh, I like that. I'm going to have to get one.
Yes, it's done by the RDNA, which is the Reformed Druids of North America.
Ooh, okay.
So the RDNA has, they have a very great website that talks all about their system and how they do things and how to get involved, and they've been around since 1963.
Uh-huh.
And on this handy-dandy little spreadsheet, they have different types of druidic organizations, and then in parentheses, a very rough draft.
They're not going to be committed to anything.
And it says, here are four of the larger groups in the United States. Others might be added for comparison in later editions. So they already admit that there are other druidic groups that are not included, and that this is specifically United States related. But I will tell you, one of the groups on this list is the OBOD, the Order of Bards, Obeids, and Druids, and that actually originated in the UK.
It does.
It
yes.
has an offshoot now in the United States and Canada and Australia, but it originated in
the motherland.
Of England.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. Where do we want to start? Like,
well,
a million things.
Well, what can I tell you? I'm going to let you. You've got the best reference.
All right.
I'm sitting here trying to go through all my notes.
Well, let's start with the OBOD because I feel like they're kind of the big one.
Okay, let's go.
So the OBOD is got a massive membership. They say that they have over 2,500 members. And I honestly don't know when this little spreadsheet was made.
Mm-hmm.
So this could be really outdated material.
Mm-hmm.
Their website is druidry.org. So if you're interested, they have a message board. And I'll tell you what, I have utilized the OBOD message board a million times.
Oh, wow.
There's just so many people on there and so many subcategories and people studying Gaelic and Welsh and Irish and different forms of divination. And it's a really great website.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that.
Mm-hmm.
The OBOD is generally eclectic.
Right.
But they work on a grove system, so you can be an independent, a solitary OBOD member and do your own solitary work through their system.
Okay.
But you could also start a grove and have a learning group, a grove group that you work with, and your grove group is basically autonomous, but you do report to the larger organization, and it is considered an initiatory fraternity more than it is considered a church.
Okay.
Let's see what else is important here. They have national offices that are done by elections, and the groves all vote on who holds sort of those leadership titles.
Okay.
Each grove has a senior druid. There is a central office. I don't know where it is, probably in the UK. There are used to be involved. There are some books, and oh, man, his name has just disappeared from my head.
It's gone somewhere.
Philip Cargram. Ha-ha, it came back. He's a pretty prominent member of the OBOD. He might even be like the archdruid right now. I don't know for sure.
Okay.
He's written a buttload of books that are pretty great, and I've heard arguments that they're maybe not as scholarly as they appear on the surface, but they're pretty great.
Sometimes scholarly, scholarly, you get slogged into all these other things. And, you know, yes, you may want all the references to feel that you've got a valid point of reference to go with, but.
Right. So the other things about the OBOD, at least from this handy-dandy spreadsheet here, is They don't have a formal seminary program, but they do have a formal study program.
Mm-hmm.
And their Grove status to get set up is a moderate program. It's not super simple. It's not very complicated. It's somewhere in between.
Okay.
And this is my favorite category of the RDNA. Like, if I had to pick a Druid group, I would probably make this category be my final decision.
And it is.
Humor.
I think that would be right.
But it's the humor level of each organization. And the OBOD, it says, less prominent.
Less prominent. Doesn't have a lot of humor.
I take it those OBODers are serious.
Serious druids.
Super
yep.
serious.
Super serious.
All right, so then we'll move on to the RDNA, who made this handy-dandy spreadsheet, because they've been around the next longest.
Mm-hmm.
In 1963 is when it was officially created. There are about 4,000 members overall, 450 different groves.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever. They're in the United States. There are some in Japan, Canada, and France.
Mm-hmm.
Their website seems like this can't be right, so I'm going to tell you what it says, but they've got to have a better website than this. But it's geocities.com/MikeERDNA. That seems
weird.
Yeah, that seems like that's got to be bunk. But whatever. It's an eclectic group.
Okay.
They no longer have a national legislature, so each of their groves are their own independent organizations. There's no formal methods that are set in place because they no longer have a national structure.
Mm-hmm.
There are no fees. There are just two basic tenets, and the groves make up whatever rules that they put onto their membership.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have a seminary program. They don't have a formal study program. Their setup system is very simple, and their humor is prominent.
Yes, I think that was, it's interesting because as you're going along, I remember reading about these, but this is such a well-done
spreadsheet. Yeah.
But, yeah, I remember that was one of the things. They have, like, two tenets, and it's almost like nature is good. Second one, nature is good.
Yeah.
You know, something like that.
Right. So the next one is the ADF, which is a Druid Fellowship, and there is actually a Gaelic name for this fellowship that I cannot pronounce and I'm not going to try. So I apologize to any ADF members. If you want to send me a note on how to pronounce this English word, I will happily try.
There you go.
There are over 600 members, about 60 groves. They are around the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Their website is adf.org.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Indo-European is their orientation, so I'm guessing that means they mostly work with the Celtic gods.
Right.
Right, and that system.
Right.
They do put out official statements pretty uh-huh. regularly. They do have detailed bylaws. They have national elections and grove office elections.
Uh-huh.
Their leadership does have a central office. There is an archdruid of the entire organization.
Uh-huh.
Each grove will have a senior druid. They do have a seminary program, a formal seminary program, and a formal study program. Their grove setup is pretty complicated.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do want to start a study group, you have to follow specific guidelines to
right.
be viewed as in their laws.
Right.
And, of course, the most important category, their humor level is moderate. And I know some ADF druids, and they seem like pretty great folks. So.
Yeah.
Of all, I know a ton of OBOD folks, but mostly online.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any RDNA folks.
Mm-hmm.
I know quite a few ADF. And then the next organization on this little spreadsheet is the Keltria. I know no people in that organization
mm-hmm.
either. But they're in, so the ADF is an offshoot of RDNA.
Right.
Right? And Keltria is an offshoot of ADF. So we have the grandson or granddaughter or grandchild of RDNA is Keltria.
Okay.
Right?
Got it.
There's about 300 members. It's mostly in the United States. Doesn't look like they've reached a global
mm-hmm.
international status.
Mm-hmm.
They're Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
Their system is Celtic. They occasionally put out statements from the organization. They do have a national election system and a grove offices. They have a central office. There are senior druids. They also have a formal seminary program and a
mm-hmm.
formal study program.
Mm-hmm.
Their grove setup is moderate, so it's not simple and not complicated.
Right.
And also, their humor is moderate.
They kind of are the in-between.
Yes.
The middle child.
Yes. Hmm. Yes. And I forgot to mention the OBOD was started in 1962, but it's actually an offshoot of the ancient Druid order, which is believed to have started in the 1800s, I think. So, but also in the UK. So there's also some, you know,
uh-huh.
We come from the land that the OBOD
we will touch the land.
Yeah.
I do have a point here to, I'm going to ask this because this is one of those. Well, are any of these things actually related to the Druid organizations that we see here in our California / United States, like the ones that have the Masonics? So there's an actual Druid organization.
Oh, like the Oddfellows?
Yes.
The Druid group?
Yes.
So I don't actually know 100%, but I know that at one, you know, we have the Masons
mm-hmm.
and the Oddfellows,
mm-hmm.
and then there was an order of Druids.
Mm-hmm.
But it was mostly a fraternity.
Right.
Right? So there were rituals, and just like the Masons, and levels that you
uh-huh.
would rise through, but it was mostly a fraternal organization, not necessarily a magical or nature-based organization.
And do you think that when things got started in the revivalist area,
mm-hmm.
that it started out in, yes, a way of reconnecting to the spiritual side of it, but I wonder, by virtue of something like the Order of Druids here, and obviously shooting it back to the motherland.
Mm-hmm.
The point being is that they started as a fraternal organization,
yeah.
that where guys got together and hung out and
yeah.
did their thing, and then eventually, you know, there was kind of like the meanderings, like, oops, we actually fell over real history, and oh my God, there's really something here.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Because I know people had the feeling to go do this.
Right.
And so they're separate and they're off doing their spiritual, you
right.
know, questing. But I also look at how, just as the Masonics,
yeah.
just as the Oddfellows, and, you know, even the Shriners,
yeah, yeah.
The groups, they've started as fraternal organizations. They started as groupings together, and in some way, not just for their personal level, but then to help.
Yes.
The environment,
well,
or what was going on.
Let's think about, like, just, let's just be logical. Like, take the woo and the, you know, the romantic part of me that wants the Druid organization to be, like, secretly Druids,
mm-hmm.
you know, right? Let's just be logical. Before the internet, the main distraction for the American household was television.
Mm-hmm.
Before television, the main distraction was the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And this is only going back to, what, the early 1900s?
Early 1900s.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So for hundreds of years, what did people, and even through television, like even up through the 80s probably,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
These fraternal and sorority organizations,
mm-hmm.
people went to socialize.
Mm-hmm.
People went to the Moose Lodge and the Elk Lodge and the Oddfellows Hall to socialize
mm-hmm.
and to come together in community
mm-hmm.
and to have fundraisers to help the school build
mm-hmm.
a new blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Like this was these organizations were ways for people to socialize. And in a way to keep it fun and engaging,
uh-huh.
there were these systems, and you rose through the ranks, and you got your merit badges, so to speak, in order to become a third level, an eighth level, and a grand poobah, or whatever the
uh-huh.
fuck it was, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I don't know any, well, that's not true. I don't know very many people that are still going to sign up to be a Freemason.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know very many people that are officially an Oddfellows. I know where lots of halls are. I know how much it costs to rent them because we rent them for witchy things sometimes.
Right.
But I don't know anyone who's officially an Oddfellow.
Right.
Right? We've kind of fallen away from that. And what's replaced these fraternal orders is the internet. I can go and sign up for the OBOD right now, pay my $25 or whatever it is,
uh-huh.
become a member of that organization, and kind of get my community on this
online.
Growing box.
Right.
Right? So it's kind of sad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that, you know, over the years, and it's and I'm going at this because, truthfully, when you have a revival, it's because there's something that they're looking for.
Yeah.
And it isn't necessarily always when, from our perspective, it's spiritual, because that's
right.
where we come from.
Right.
But you look at the community,
yep.
and if you also go back to what we were talking about in terms of the historical process,
right.
they were the connectors of the community.
Yes, And there's also a lineage thing here, too. Like, mm-hmm. there's the Sons of Norway, which mm-hmm. is not a racist organization, but this was people who moved to the United States mm-hmm. but wanted to keep some of their culture.
Of course.
So all of the Norwegians got together and created this organization.
Right.
And now those of us that are descended from Norwegians, and actually most of these organizations will take anyone now because mm-hmm. people don't do this as much
right.
as they used to.
Right.
But it used to be like the DAR, which I didn't know about until watching the Gilmore Girls.
Well, you're looking at a DAR.
But the DAR, right? You had to prove you were descended.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
You had to prove you were a daughter of the revolution.
Yes, you
and
did.
Prove it.
Yeah.
You still have to prove
you
it.
You still have to prove it on their, on right? their structure.
So there are ways of also showing, like, look at this cool thing that I get to be a part of
mm-hmm.
because of my lineage,
mm-hmm.
which is something Americans severely lack.
Right.
So this was a way to give us another way to be in community,
right.
another way to celebrate our ancestry, another way to,
mm-hmm.
to connect.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And again, we lost that. It's not, at least on the West Coast, maybe the DAR is still a big...
Well, they have here, actually, they have the Sons
Eastern
of Golden... No, the Sons of the West, the Golden West.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason why I know that is back when I was in high school, a long time ago, there were essay contests.
Mm-hmm.
You could get, scholarships and monies and things.
Right.
And the Sons of the West put on a particular, thing, and I kind of got roped into it by my high school teacher, the history teacher, and trust me, didn't expect that were coming. So they do, based on locally, yes, the Sons of the West, and then the Daughters of the West, because, see, the reasons why, and this is what happened, is that when you had the SR, which is the Sons of the Revolution, they're like the super pure.
Mm.
Then you have the SAR, Sons of the American Revolution. They're all from the revolution, but it's specifically through the male line. It's like really direct. Then you have the DAR,
mm.
and Daughters of the Revolution were a little bit, you can't quite get it. It had to be through the main father line.
Right, of course.
The DR. And then the American. And it was done, yes, to provide lineage.
Yeah.
It was also done to be able to feel you have, you're part of something.
Right, exactly.
The community.
Exactly.
Process. So,
exactly.
And it goes through the same thing as well. We didn't have, one of my husbands, since I have so many, said, your side, your mother's side, is actually American royalty.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't American royalty based on being part of J.P. Morgan and the
right.
Rothschild.
Not the good money royalty.
No, but it was the royalty of the land.
Yeah.
And I never really thought about it. I was like, because it was a social group. My
yes.
mother did it as a social thing.
Yes.
She got us kids in there to not necessarily socially, but to know something
big
about, to connect.
Yep.
And then I kind of wandered through and got
right.
into the other side. I was also the rebel because I felt that, we came from rebel stock. So if I was going to go as a CAR and do the, we were pages at the state conference.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I had to be a page at the state conference. I wore a miniskirt. I was all in white with my little white gloves, but I wore a miniskirt. And before that, of course, at the very, very fancy opening gala, I wore, from Frederick's, this very nice low cut, up the button, but they were not buttoned. It was definitely, and I'm holding the flag, and, of course, the top and the thing were like,
clutching their pearls.
They were clutching their pearls. Their mouths were
yeah.
open because my leg would flip, and it
yeah.
was not showing any crotch or anything. It was just showing leg as I walked because of me.
Passed.
I know. Because of me, 2 years later, they had instituted a dress
of
code.
Course.
But I kept looking at it. The ladies of my mother's chapter loved me. They said, "You are the rebel. You really are." And I was taking it to heart at that time because, as a teenager, it gave me a focus. So
yeah.
I kept thinking how stodgy.
Right.
That's what's causing the implosion of all of these organizations,
yeah.
be they what I'm talking about or
yeah.
others, is they're too stodgy. They haven't learned to find a way to
right.
look at who they really were, their roots, and follow a little bit more of that openness.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, you know, like you said, we're looking at this through a filter of woo because we're coming from a spiritual standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really, I mean, if you come right down to the heart of it, that's what this is about. Our spiritual life
mm-hmm.
is about connecting to the planet, connecting to something bigger than ourselves.
Right.
You call that God or community. It is something bigger than ourselves.
Right.
And that's what these organizations do. But, you know, the Fellows and
mm-hmm.
the OBOD and
mm-hmm.
whatever, you know, Grove or circle you might have available in your community. And that's the other thing that's amazing about the glowing box,
mm-hmm.
how I can connect to community, is if I live in the middle of Arkansas and there is no
mm-hmm.
outlet for spiritual community, there aren't any practicing groves, there
right.
aren't any out-of-the-closet witches,
right.
I can go to the OBOD website and connect with people who are like-minded, who get it, and who might also be isolated.
So we don't have to be isolated anymore.
Right. It takes away that particular process.
Yeah.
There's the pluses and the minuses.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's the same thing as any, you know, anything, whether it's this or it's medicine. There are pluses and minuses for allopathic medicine.
Yeah.
There are pluses and minuses for government.
Yeah.
And structure.
Yeah.
I thought. There we are.
And that's our time.
And that's our time because we're like, oh, my gosh.
We didn't, to give a check-in, we didn't babble about any other random crap, and we have only slightly touched the surface of Druid stuff.
Which we will, again, take as a forward movement
yeah.
For other shows.
Yeah.
But this show, you'll be listening to this at some point in the month of March of 2018, unless you're listening to it on archive.
Of
and
course.
It could be sometime in the future. Hello, future.
Hello.
Hope it's grand there.
Yes.
But the week following this week, we're doing a show on ritual etiquette.
Ah.
How to be a good participant.
This will be fun. We're going to have a lot to say.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You know me and my big mouth and strong
opinion. That's so. The joy, kiddo. That's
Yay.
The joy. Yes. Okay, free speech. And with
All
that,
right.
you have a wonderful, wonderful week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Witch, The Priestess, and The Cauldron, a radio podcast on the LMC Radio Network. Our podcast airs live every Friday at 6 p.m. Pacific and will be available for download. Questions or comments on this show or ideas for upcoming shows can be sent to our website, and that's at www.witchpriestesscauldron.com. Again, that's witchpriestesscauldron.com. On behalf of Elvira, Phoenix, Alan, and myself, Gwion Raven, a big merry meet and merry part and merry meet again. Blessed be.